A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sean Kane.
We kick off 2020 with children's author Owen Colfer. Later on, we'll be talking about the books that made our own childhoods. When Owen Colfer's novel Artemis Fowl was tearing up the bestseller charts in 2001, it seemed as if the author had cracked the recipe for getting reluctant boys to read. Take one part adventure, one part tech, mix in some fairies and add farts. The eight-book series completed its arc in 2012, when the young villain Artemis finds a kind of redemption. But Colfer returns to the Fowl universe with a story involving Artemis's younger twin brothers Miles and Beckett. The Fowl twins finds the brothers on the rampage with a troll and a fairy in training. When he came to the studio, Sean began by asking him to read from the book, where the reader first gets to know Miles and Beckett.
Behold Miles and Beckett Fowl passing a late summer evening on the family's private beach. If you look past the superficial differences, wardrobe, spectacles, hairstyles and so on, you notice that the boys' facial features are very similar but not absolutely identical. This is because they are dizygotic twins and were in fact the first recorded non-identical twins to be born conjoined, albeit only from wrist to little finger. The attending surgeon separated them with a flash of her scalpel, and neither twin suffered any ill effects apart from matching pink scars that ran along the outside of their palms. Miles and Beckett often touched scars to comfort each other. It was their version of a high five, which they called a wrist bump. This habit was both touching and slightly gross. Apart from their features, the fraternal twins were, as one tutor noted, very different animals. Miles had an IQ of 170 and was fanatically neat, while Beckett's IQ was a mystery because he chewed the test into pulpy blobs from which he made a sculpture of a hamster in a bad mood, which he titled Angry Hamster.
Owen Colfer, welcome to the Guardian Books podcast.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, I've got to say, 10-year-old me, who is very similar to 28-year-old me, is very happy right now because I grew up reading the Artemis Fowl books since the very first book came out in 2001, I always had a real sort of fondness for Artemis Fowl because it was the one book apart from Harry Potter that I could convince the adults around me to read as well.
Well, nice. It's funny that somewhere, even though in my mind I'm like 27, somehow I've become a nostalgia act partially. Partially, so like there's me in Tears for Fears wondering what happened. are we not the cutting edge anymore? But no, it's really nice when you go to a reading and parents are there with their kids, and the parents have their old Artemis books and the kids have the Fowl twins. So it's nice to be able to forge that bridge. Now, I'm not saying that I personally I'm keeping families together, but I do take
I take a large part
of the credit for that.
I mean, so the Artemis Fowl books, for anyone that hasn't read them, they were a series of eight books about a child genius who learns that fairies exist, and he starts an extortion scheme to get his hands on some fairy gold, and he holds an elf hostage, and it turns out she's part of the sort of fairy police service, and their full might is brought down on his family's estate in Ireland. And you've called it Die Hard with Fairies, which I think is actually a very good sort of shorthand description. Yeah. But and it's also been called James Bond with fairies. And I understand that there is a sort of connection with James Bond in that Artemis is, at the start of the series, a sort of tiny boy that wears suits, which is quite strange. And you've said that it has a connection to your brother, Donal. Is that right?
Yeah, I remember seeing a photo of Donal in his communion suit, And he looked, it was in the 1980s, so it was kind of a Roger Moore era Bond. So it was like double-breasted safari kind of suit. And it was very fancy for the time. And but in this photo, he had a little smirk because he knew how good he looked. And I just thought he looks like a Bond villain who's only 10. And that notion stuck with me for a long time.
Yeah.
I thought that would be quite a funny thing to explore, a little 10-year-old villain. So when I wrote the first Artemis book, I just plonked my brother down. But the more I wrote it, the more I saw this guy is not just the villain, he's the lead. So I elevated him to the main character. And then I thought, well, no one's going to read it now because it's a bad guy. But I was having so much fun that I didn't stop and I just finished the book. And I honestly thought that it would be a little blip and then I would go on to the next thing. So when I got an agent from that, and next thing I had a movie deal and the publishers wanted 3 books, and I found it all kind of, I was bemused by the whole thing. And I continue to be a little bit bemused that this little idea that came from a photo has gone on for nearly 20 years now.
Yeah.
So you never know. I always tell kids who are writing, just be open to that idea, because you don't know where it's going to hit, when it's going to hit you, and you might only get one.
Yeah.
And you have to build on that.
That's interesting to hear that it was planned as just, well, sort of just was only in your mind. It was the one book.
My very first book was a book called Benny and Omar, and which did well in Ireland and strangely Denmark. That featured a scene where the lead guy, Benny, who's a 12-year-old kid, is tasked with babysitting his younger brother. And he sneaks out and leaves the brother. Now, in my mind, that is quite a normal occurrence. And I had done that myself as a child, where I was babysitting my little brothers and I just left. And I thought, well, I'll be back in an hour and nothing will happen. And there was a kind of a bit of a pushback to that character doing that thing, in that it wasn't a good example. And I didn't realize that you were supposed to be setting an example. So when I wrote Artemis, I thought, well, this guy's like an out-and-out villain. I mean, yeah, they're going to hate him. But seemingly because it was so obviously fiction, it slipped through. So I really was shocked when suddenly there was talk of charts and stuff, and it was a big shock to me. And I had a lot of trouble writing the second book, but once I got over that, I was fine. But I thought for the second book, I felt that huge pressure of the last book did this well, and now you want the second book to do equally as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It must be quite a strange adjustment to make, to suddenly view something that started with a photo of your brother as like a franchise, as a big franchise.
Well, I often, I wrote these books in the baby's bedroom, but only when the baby was not asleep. So I couldn't even have the room a lot of the time. It was literally beside the changing table. And that is the smell I associate with work, like nappies and talcum powder.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I would say that I have never had a better writing experience than when I was working during the day, teaching, and then writing furiously at night. And my wife was running a boutique and we had a baby.
And the interesting thing about your books is that they do transcend. They are children's books, but they do transcend. There are things in them that adults really love. Yeah. And you do sometimes find it with children's authors that they do have some sort of particular connection to children, that they have some sort of shared sense of humor, or they're on some sort of wavelength. They like how children think, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is that true of you, or is it just so happens that you write children's books?
I think I was teaching kids when I started writing books for kids. Before that, I had written a few plays and I had tried my hand at a crime novel. But with the kids' books, I was actually teaching them at the time, and it came to me very quickly, the wavelength. But there are people, I think a great example of that is Oliver Jeffers. He does picture books, but literally anyone can read them, especially his new one, Fausto, which is a fable. But there are no kids in that book, you know, but just anybody can read them and anybody can love them. Michael Morpurgo, is another one. Jacqueline Wilson, J.K. Rowling, of course. There's just, the list goes on. And I do believe that if it's a decent book, if it's to hold up, that anyone who's able to read it would enjoy it. Mm. And that goes all the way from picture books, right up to the top end. And I would certainly hope that Artemis Fowl would, and the Fowl Twins would fall into that bracket. And yeah, I think there definitely are things that maybe some of the kids won't get, but I try and make sure that they don't interfere with the plot.
No.
And that they're not very obviously done where I'm trying to be meta and wink wink, because I think that, I don't like that, but I do like to put in some jokey names for the grown-ups. My favourite one is the dwarf, Colin, who is a digger of dark smelly holes, but his second name is Oscopy, so his full name is Colin Oscopy, and the parent doesn't know that until they get onto the page and they're just hijacked with it, and they've suddenly said colonoscopy and they're laughing and the kid wants to know why you're laughing, Dad. So that is the kind of
sneaking in gags for the
sneaking
the
gags that will hopefully make a parent explain something that is well ahead of their child's development. I like the idea. It's probably never happened, but I like to think it would. But you're in a room on your own for 9 months, so you have to keep yourself entertained.
I'm really interested in authors that I would define it in my own mind as comic writers. And I guess actually, like, rereading Artemis Fowl and reading this book, The Fowl Twins, like reading it as an adult, immediately the comparisons I make now as an adult rather than to other children's books are things like perhaps some of Neil Gaiman's work and Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams as well.
Yeah, well, I will. Those are three of my heroes, and I was lucky enough to have met two out of three. So I never met Douglas, even though I finished up the Hitchhikers.
Yeah, you wrote the sixth book in the
I did. I mean, I shouldn't really say finished up. In my mind, it was kind of licensed fan fiction. I met Terry Pratchett one time at an award show. Well, I say met him. I kind of ran after him. He was leaving early. And at this time, I was getting quite disillusioned with touring. And I don't know how he knew that. And he said, "You have to tour." He said, "There's a handful of us came out of the 70s and the only ones still going are the ones who tour.
Right.
And you've got to meet your readers because they want to meet you." And that was, to hear that from Terry Pratchett, and then he kind of swirled his cloak and ducked into a carriage.
Put his hat on.
He has his hat on and his cloak. I'd made up the carriage bit, but the rest is true. And I was so, in awe of Terry Pratchett that I immediately went on the road.
And so then you wrote Artemis Fowl books for about 15 years, and there were 8 of them. And then I was listening back to an interview you gave when the last book came out, and you were saying that you were relieved to be saying goodbye to Artemis, but you're also upset about it. And so then now you're back with the Fowl Twins, which is Artemis's little brothers, Beckett and Miles. So what was the decision like in terms of going, actually, no, I am going to return to this world, but not Artemis?
I had that plot in mind, but when I finished Artemis, but at the time I just felt too saturated with fairy lore, and I felt I'd been in that world so long that I couldn't face going back to another volume. So I just thought, I'm going to take 5 or 6 years out, and then if there's any appetite for it, I will go back and do a Fowl Twin. So I just did the first chapter, and my agent sent that out, and I was very lucky to sign with HarperCollins, who I'd done Imaginary Fred with Oliver Jeffers, so I knew the team, and I was really happy to go in there, and it's been just great. And I don't think I'll do such a long series. My current plan is a trilogy, and then definitely I'll tell my wife I'm retiring. We'll see what happens.
And was it at all daunting or anything to enter back into this world again and sort of have to pick up some things where you left off and then also establish new characters?
Yeah, it was a little daunting, because when you leave something on a real high, and the whole, I wanted to get out of Artemis while it was still doing well on all fronts, in that it was critically doing well and it was selling well and people still wanted to see me. And having left that for 5 years or 6 years, which is a long time in children's books, because all the kids who were reading it have now grown up, and sometimes the kids do not want their parents writers, they want their own new writers. And children's writing has really changed, in that it's become this amazing inclusive arena
where everybody is represented, which is fantastic. So I don't know my place in that yet. And so to go back in there, yeah, it was a challenge. But eventually I kind of just left all my worries outside the office and just said, listen, you can only write the book you're going to write and write the best book, and don't be pathetic enough to try and jump on someone's bandwagon. Just do what you do and see what happens.
And you were mentioning before about how there was, I guess with Benny and Omar, that there was this attitude of, well, kids shouldn't be doing this, so should you be writing about it? And then we've got evil genius Artemis, who's really, until maybe, like, I'd say the end of the second book, you don't really get a sense of any genuine goodness in him.
And even then it takes a few more books to kind of bubble to the surface. And I was kind of mean with Artemis, because he would do something nice and then I would make him do something horrible to undercut it. That's what I liked about it. I liked teasing the readers with, and now he's going to do a nice thing and now I'm going to take it. and it wasn't until the end of the book 8 where he does a selfless thing. He did a lot of nice things, but there was always something in
there. Was another purpose.
Yeah, he always made money, or he got rid of a rival. But in the last book, I knew that he had to do something selfless, and then that was it was all over for him. Then he was a good guy then, so it was time to send him off into space and get rid of him.
And so then, do you think, I mean, are you at all resistant to the idea that there has to be some sort of heart of gold at the heart in children's books? There has to be sort of a moral message at all?
I think there's a place for everything. I mean, I think it is nice to have books with a moral message, but also it's nice to have books that are a little bit devious and subversive, you know, and I think I'm in that bracket. I always say that, you know, if J.K. Rowling is, I don't know, take that, well, then I'm E17, you know, and we need E17, and that's who I am.
Well, I do love it. So we've got Artemis was sort of firmly our bad guy for the books, for most of the books, and then there were villains introduced, and you always got a sense that you really liked writing villains.
Yeah.
And in the Foul Twins, we have Lord Teddy Bleedemdry, who's a man of 150 plus years, who wants troll venom to achieve eternal youth.
I know. It's like, I feel I'm getting to the bottom of my baddie well now, because I love the two baddies in this. You've got Sister Geronima, who's a professional interrogator.
A nun
interrogator. And then you have Teddy Bleedemdry, who's this immortalist Duke of the Scilly Isles. And I just love that. And I spend a lot of time trying to pin down the baddies and what makes them different. And what I love about Teddy is that he knows he's the baddie. Mm. Like, most baddies don't know they're the baddie. They think they have a good cause, but he knows he's completely selfish and that he just wants to live longer, because he would enjoy to live longer, and that would be great. So whereas Sister Geronima is a fanatic, and she wants to capture these fairy people, and she'll do whatever she has to do, but she believes she's good and on the side of the angels. So you have this interesting dramatic tension between Miles and the two baddies, because Miles also realizes that he's quite the only pink person the only people he loves are in his family, and he will do outside that. He's actually more evolved than Artemis, because Artemis wanted gold, but Miles wants knowledge. And I'm working on the second book now, and he will do a lot to become the most knowledgeable person human ever, and mainly because he wants to beat Artemis at something.
Are you at all nervous about how it's going to be received, both by, I guess, this new generation of readers, but also perhaps some parents that grew up with?
I am. I mean, I say I'm not, and I'm all blasé about it, but actually, yes, you can't help being a little bit nervous. And, you know, of all the reviews, if 99 of them are fantastic and then one has something tiny, minorly negative to say, then that's what I will fix. It's a real writer's thing. I think someone said once about one of the Artemis books, some of the sentences are a bit short. I was like, what? And I read back and I was like, she's right. There's four short sentences in those 8 books. So you just can't help it. It's a very human thing to just listen to all the detractors and ignore all the praise.
Well, I have to end on, finally, that there is, as all Artemis Fowl fans have probably been aware of for about the last decade, that there's been an Artemis Fowl film planned for ages and ages and ages. I think I remember reading about it once upon a time. I think that George Clooney's production company had it at one point, yonks ago. And then now it's at Disney, which is amazing and big. But I guess for you, like, what does it feel like to have...
I am very dubious that that's, you know, that I will be alive when that happens.
Really?
I feel...
There's a trailer.
I mean, it's made and it's in the can and it's got a release date and it's all set to go in May on Memorial Day, which is a huge release day for them in the States.
Mm.
So it is happening, but it's again the Irish, you don't want to jinx it by believing it. If I believe it's going to happen, then it won't happen.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is temper my own excitement.
So you're going to wait till May next year?
I'll wait till I'm in the cinema. And then I said, what are we watching tonight? And then, you know, why am I wearing a tuxedo? And then it will happen. But it's so, and like the cast and the, like, Kenneth Branagh, it's such a sterling production.
So Branagh's directing it.
He's directing it. Callum McPherson wrote it. Judy Dench is in it, among others. The young Artemis and the young Holly are fantastic. I haven't seen the whole thing, but what I've seen looks amazing. But you see, now I'm getting very...
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I have to stop now.
Okay.
Because I will jinx it. So yeah, I think it's going to happen and everyone's very excited except me. And my only stipulation is, and I'm saying this in public now, that if my sons want to go, they have to read the book.
Oh yeah,
I think that's a fair.
Are they refusing?
Well, they're being tardy about that. They're taking their time. Well, Finn's 22 now, so he's taking a lot of time.
Has been out for 18 years.
I know. So, but Sean, I understand that it's hard to. You don't want to connect to something your dad did that might be cool to other people. It taints your whole understanding of what parents are.
Yeah.
So. We'll see. I'm sure they will read it, or else they'll get the notes. You know, there must be notes online that gives.
Give them the Cliff Notes version.
The Wikipedia Artemis page. That's where I go, actually, if I can't remember a character. Did I kill him? I type him in.
Have a look.
And have a look.
Owen Colfer. The Fowl Twins is published by HarperCollins Children's Books in the UK and Disney Hyperion in the US. After the break, we'll be reverting to childhood ourselves, or at least flicking back through some of the books we enjoyed when we were young. Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. Talking to Owen Colfer made me think about the gap between the high-velocity, scatological thrills of Artemis Fowl and the stodgy fare children had to read back in the 1970s when I was growing up. It's clear there's been a revolution in children's publishing, driven, of course, by the juggernaut that is Harry Potter. You were 6, Sian, when J.K. Rowling published The Philosopher's Stone in 97, and 16 when the series came to a close with The Deathly Hallows. So what was it like growing up with a boy wizard?
It was funny growing up with a book series like that that was so sort of important in its own time. Like, I got into Harry Potter when the first two books were out. So
right away.
Stone. Yeah. But
because, I mean, I think she sort of hit a wider audience with book three, really.
Yeah, book three was the thing that made her really massive. And the funny thing was that we had an exchange student from England that came to, so I'm from Australia, and this exchange student came from England and he had the third book and it wasn't out in Australia.
Whoa.
And he was like the coolest person in class.
Did he have specs?
No. Although, I got really into it around that point, and then it was around about book four that it became the thing that you go at. Well, it was 8 a.m. in Australia where I was from, but you know, the midnight launch.
Right. Oh, you turn up and you were queue. That's you in the queue.
Yeah, you turn up in queue. And so I really, really vividly remember like the day Deathly Hallows came out, and I was sort of in my last years of high school and going and dressing up with my friends to go get our books, and just realizing that like we were like some of the youngest people there. Like lots of people were,
20-year-olds.
And adults that had, clearly like gotten into it as teenagers. And then, there was an old bloke dressed as Hagrid in front of me in the line, I remember, eating a Twix for breakfast.
and so would the fact that these books were being so widely read by so many kids and adults alike, did this mean that people in your generation were reading more other books, or were they just reading Harry Potter?
I think that there's a lot of people that only read Harry Potter. Like, it was the only thing that they liked. And Harry Potter, Twilight, and Hunger Games were the things that people tended to read if they sort of didn't normally, they weren't regular readers. That's just in my experience. Like, it was sort of, those were the books that sort of transcended whether you were a big reader or not.
And it just became something you had to do even if you weren't much of a reader.
Yeah, it's sort of like, it was kind of word of mouth that sort of, people that didn't normally read there was enough pressure put on them by the people around them that, oh, this is a very good thing, you should give this a go. So with Harry Potter, it was kind of unavoidable, really, in terms of my generation. You couldn't really not read it. There were so many conversations going on with your friends and pop culture references and stuff. You literally couldn't really function without having some understanding of Harry Potter.
And for people like you who were reading other things as well, what about the rest of the children's publishing boom? Is there a dog-eared copy of Artemis Fowl on your
shelves? Oh, totally, yeah. No, my parents still have all my Artemis Fowl books in Australia because my dad really likes Artemis Fowl. So there were like certain series, like Artemis Fowl and Harry Potter were the two things that I could get adults around me to read. Like there was enough humour in there, because I think rereading Owen Colfer now, I kind of see, oh, there's like quite a lot of Terry Pratchett in him. Like there is a real sort of comedy there that I think a lot of adult readers would really, really enjoy. There's probably loads of jokes that I wouldn't have got at the time. And so I've got all my Artemis Fowls still at home, and my dad loves them. I also grew up Philip Pullman, but Philip Pullman was something that I think I with his Dark Materials, I got into quite late because I had no interest in some of the sort of deeper themes of the books until I was a bit older.
And less popular with the grown-ups around you.
Yeah, my dad never, using my dad as my barometer because he was the guy I could convince to read. He never really got Philip Pullman. But it was a really good time to be a kid and be reading, because so young adult fiction as like a genre was already a thing when I was a teenager, but I got to sort of see it explode, and it was a very sort of cool time to be a nerdy kid that read a lot, because there were so many books around. There was a sort of sense you were being catered for, and it wasn't necessarily a nerdy thing to be a reader.
Yeah, but actually sort of seen for the first time by the books industry. Yeah. Sure. Well, I mean, you also got in slightly before what I think of as the kind of Hunger Games years, because that was published in 2008, and everything went very dystopian for a few years after that.
I was a bookseller in about 2009, 2010, when I started, and I saw that huge explosion in both Twilight and in Hunger Games. And there was a period where, like, basically every second customer would be buying one or the other. And then after that, it all went 50 Shades. Like, it was really funny. You can sort of see the tailing off of Twilight and then people coming and buying 50 Shades.
Was it the same people?
It really was. Like, there was a really big crossover. I felt so uncomfortable selling 50 Shades to teenagers, but there's no law against it, so there you go. It is quite a cool time now, I think. Like, you said before that you feel like children's literature was a bit stodgy. I mean, I loved quite a lot of classic stuff. But
did you read any of that stuff? Yeah, with that explosion going on around you.
So I read a lot of Famous Five.
Did you?
I didn't like Secret Seven. Too many kids. The dog was boring. And I
could never abide the Famous Five. All the jolly hockey sticks and ginger beer.
It's just so made good. But I also I read a lot of Hardy Boys and a lot of Trixie Belden. Did you get Trixie Belden?
Didn't get as far as Trixie Bell, but the Hardy Boys were, that was basically the only books that I could see in, you know, that were kind of aimed at kids my age.
And Nancy Drew as well. I read a lot of sort of serialized, quite hammy books about teenagers solving crimes.
Because it's that slot, isn't it? That slot between picture books and grown-ups that just didn't really exist. I mean, you know, because when I was growing up, the picture books were already pretty great because things happened in the 60s. So there was things like Raymond Briggs' Jim and the Beanstalk was 66, Father Christmas, 1973, The Snowman, 1978. John Birmingham, the great John Birmingham, Borker, 1963, Trubloff, The Mouse Who Wanted to Play the Balalaika is 1964, and William Steig's Amos and Boris, 1972, another key text.
What's Amos and Boris?
Well, perhaps you know Julia Donaldson, The Snail and the Whale.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically the same story,
okay,
except with a mouse.
Okay.
And not in rhyme. And better pick. Oh, I didn't say that. But for me, so with this kind of vast gulf between those picture books and then kind of grown-up books, there was kind of myths and legends that did it for me when I was... So I remember Roger Lanson Green's telling of the Tales of the Norsemen, which I've got the opening of it here because it's just so marvellous and cold. Mm-hmm. In the northern lands, the summer is short and the winter long and cold, he writes. Life is a continual battle against the grim powers of nature, against the cold and the darkness. The snow and ice of winter, the bitter winds, the bare rocks where no green thing will grow, and against the terrors of dark mountains and wolf-haunted ravines. Who couldn't thrill to that? And then you've got his sun-dappled Greek heroes as well. They were great. There was also a kind of certain amount of kind of real life stuff. I mean, they were still when I was growing up, they were kind of the kind of Second World War comics that we all passed around, Banzai, all that stuff. Which was kind of just an interesting kind of indoctrination to the colonial art. but there was kind of also real life kind of stories of kind of great sort of adventures or people fighting in planes or wars or whatever, or, you know, strange but true kind of football stories. So
that was the thing that I discovered when I moved here. Biggles.
Yeah, there
Biggles
you go.
Are massive, and I'd never heard of Biggles when I was in Australia.
We're still reliving it even now. The Second World War is with us still, folks. But beyond that, it's kind of fantasy. There was The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster, which I recall as being surreal and slightly odd but slightly marvellous as well. Or there's the books that were written for grown-ups. So we read Huckleberry Finn or Treasure Island or, you know, White Fang, or into, you know, things like fantasy, like The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, which, I mean, is kind of where we've arrived back with added farts with Owen Colfer.
It's Lord of the Rings with farts. I'm sure he'd like that.
And a much more kind of a sort of thrillerish firecracker kind of plot as well.
Lord of
the Rings takes its time about the landscape. I mean, he's obsessed with leading trees and hills and all that stuff.
Yeah, I find The Hobbit the most boring book on earth. Like, I know I love Lord of the Rings, but
no stamina.
Hobbit,
that's your
the
problem.
Worst.
Anyway, that's all for this week. With next week, Samantha Harvey joins us to discuss a subject that will be very dear to us in just a little less than 24 hours: sleep. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, get in touch on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And remember, you can subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, for me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.